Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on the treatment of HR-positive early-stage breast cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from an on-demand educational activity, Drs. Joyce O'Shaughnessy, Virginia Cocklemani, and Seth Wander discuss real-world insights into tailoring adjuvant therapy regimens in HR-positive, HER2-negative early breast cancer. This activity is provided by PER and supported by educational grants from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Merck Sharp and Dohm LLC.
Seth and Virginia, let's go ahead and look at this patient who's a 43-year-old premenopausal woman. She had a mastectomy, and her biopsy had shown a 6-centimeter invasive lobular cancer, ER 80%, PR 10%, HER2 IHC 0, and really very slow growing, Ki 67-10% grade 2. But at mastectomy, she did have 3 of 3 positive central lymph nodes. And then she went on to have an axillary lymph node dissection, which found 2 additional axillary lymph nodes. So she actually had 5 of 15 positive nodes. So this is a dilemma because she's got this indolent type disease, but she's got 5 nodes and she is premenopausal. So would you send a genomic signature? Is this a patient you're on the fence about giving chemotherapy to? So if she came back with a low genomic score, you wouldn't give her chemotherapy? And let's look at a couple of different scenarios. Let's see that on the one hand, we find out she's germline BRCA 1-2 a negative, or on the other hand, she is germline BRCA mutation positive. So Seth, how about you? Is this a patient you'd consider a genomic signature for?
Thanks, Joyce. I think this is a challenging situation because you can feel yourself being a little bit pulled in both directions. On the one hand, we know that these slower growing lobular breast cancers might not respond as robustly to chemotherapy. On the other hand, she's a premenopausal patient who would really be out of bounds, for example, on the TAILOR-X study. She has a T3 tumor with N2 disease. And so we feel compelled to offer cytotoxic chemotherapy, knowing that the biology of her disease may not be as sensitive. But at the same time, if you were to forgo chemotherapy, I think it would be potentially inappropriate based on the inclusion criteria for those studies. So in my opinion, I would not get for example, an Oncotype, the first rule in medical school that's hard to integrate is don't get a test if it's not going to change your behavior. And I think in this case, it wouldn't change my behavior. I would feel compelled to offer her treatment. But as you were alluding to a moment ago, I think giving her chemo would be important, but most important will be getting her optimal extended duration anti-estrogen therapy with appropriate targeted therapy that I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Seth. Let me just ask you, you're going to give her chemo, it sounds like. What chemo would you give her?
Here's another one that I think the magnitude of benefit for anthracycline here is somewhat difficult to appreciate, but she does have 5 positive lymph nodes with a large tumor. And I think I would discuss dose-dense ACT with her. In my gut, I'm sort of thinking that the absolute magnitude of the Adriamycin is hard to pin down here, but she does have N2 disease. I think if she had N1 disease, fewer positive lymph nodes, I might consider foregoing the anthracycline. But given her young age and the extent of her axillary involvement, I would probably offer her what I thought was the sort of most aggressive cytotoxic chemotherapy.
Thanks. Thank you, Seth. How about you, Virginia? Would you consider a genomic score like a MAMA print? And I know, of course, you guys are doing the SWOG-2206 trial. So how would you incorporate a genomic score into her management?
So she came to me pre-surgical, then I would consider sending the MAMA print to see if she's eligible for the S2206. But if she comes to me post-operatively, then as Seth said, I would feel compelled to give her chemotherapy. She's premenopausal, young premenopausal patient with 5 positive lymph nodes. So I would definitely give her chemotherapy. Now, if there were reasons to try to avoid ACT, which is what I would also do, I'd be thinking of giving TC, but for 6 cycles instead of 4, because this is the data that we have. And if you look at how easy it is to give TC times 6, it's not really very easy. It causes a lot of neuropathy, a lot of arthralgias. So, as far as acute adverse events, I really don't think that ACT is any worse than TC6.
Yeah. And with six of docetaxel at 75, you run that 1 to 2% risk of permanent alopecia. And I've seen it. I've seen it with like the preoperative TCHP over the years, you know. We used to see it a lot with 100 per meter of docetaxel times four, which we never use anymore, but I've seen it with TAC times six, you know. And so it is a it's a consideration. We got to tell patients, you know, about that and see if they can possibly scalp cool just to preserve their hair follicles so it would come back in. I agree with you guys. I would be looking at an ACT like regimen. I think we all will be happy when we have the results of the offset trial. And we, you know, and that's of course 1 to 3 nodes. It's not four or more, but it's the high risk node negative and 1 to 3 nodes. And the 21 gene recurrence score, if it's 25 or under, then they get randomized to chemo, no chemo, in addition to optimal endocrine therapy with an LHRH agonist and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And I think I always tell patients that doctors are kind of betting that the chemotherapy won't add in the context of optimal endocrine therapy. Otherwise, they'd never randomize half of their patients to not get something if they thought it was going to work for them. You know what I mean? So, but that's going to be a long time coming, the offset trial. I think we'll probably extrapolate to the four more nodes once we have the results of the offset trial, don't you think? I mean, if it comes back that chemo doesn't add, you know, for the 1 to 3 nodes, I can't imagine it would add to four or five positive nodes, you know? We're going to give this patient adjuvant ACT, and then she's going to get radiation therapy, post-mastectomy radiation therapy, and IV zoledronic acid. I'm just curious what your choice of endocrine therapy would be, CDK4/6 inhibitor, and what if she had a BRCA mutation? What do you think, Virginia?
So if she's BRCA negative, I think it's clear I would definitely do ovarian suppression, an aromatase inhibitor, and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And in this case, because she's eligible for both CDK4/6 inhibitors, I would look at the fact that monarchE is more mature as far as a trial. It has an overall survival benefit. So I would favor that approach at least to start, and assuming the patient tolerates it. If she's BRCA positive, she's eligible for a PARP inhibitor. She's eligible for olaparib. So here we need to kind of think about, do we give olaparib? Do we give the CDK4/6 inhibitor? What do we do? And there's some nice data generated from Memorial Sloan Kettering that these patients that have germline BRCA2 mutations, because mostly are they're BRCA2, they seem to have their tumors seem to be relatively resistant to CDK4/6 inhibitors. And so I would definitely give the olaparib first and complete a year. After I was done with the olaparib, I could consider starting the CDK4/6 inhibitor and doing 2 or 3 years, depending on which one we gave. But I think the biggest part of my treatment would be the PARP inhibitor.
Yeah, thank you. But you'd consider sequencing with, and I guess you know, as I was thinking, I've not been sending the primary cancer for NGS. I think they found out that, you know, the RB gene is close by on the chromosome to BRCA2, and as the cancer loses that second copy of BRCA2, that they can lose RB, and when you lose RB, the CDK4/6 inhibitors don't work. And that was a super cool observation, you know, like you said, but I've not been sending the tissue, you know, for NGS. I have for these very high risk patients, I give them the year of olaparib, and I do generally come in with some the 2 years of abemaciclib afterwards. I figure, gosh, everything we can possibly do for these patients, but I haven't been sending for NGS, you know, to see and I don't, yeah, but it should have been a something in the primary cancer as opposed to a resistance. It would not be a resistance thing. So we might find it in the primary. It'd be nice to have more data on that. You know what I mean? So we could actually help, you know, figure out what to do. How about you, Seth? What would you do with her? You know, she's BRCA negative, BRCA positive.
I agree completely with the great points that Virginia made, and First, for a BRCA negative situation, we certainly want to optimize endocrine therapy with ovarian suppression and extended duration treatment on an AI. For these lobular ER-positive breast cancers, as we were just alluding to, I think this is the backbone of their risk reduction over the long term. And she would meet criteria, as we just discussed, for both. And I also agree, I would favor monarchE given the long duration of follow-up off drug, as well as now the overall survival benefit. If she were both BRCA and would meet criteria for adjuvant CDK. I agree completely. And I think the point Virginia made is really important one that's underappreciated, that we have some emerging data from that nice study about the impact of germline BRCA and response to CDK. Now, even before we had that data, most of us were paradoxically kind of going for the PARP inhibitor because we had survival data for the PARP inhibitor first before we had survival data for monarchE. So we would do, if a patient was eligible for both, we would often try to give the PARP inhibitor first because we had survival data. It was a shorter duration of therapy and then get on to the CDK. Now, interestingly, when you look at the magnitude of the difference on the order of 2 to 3% survival improvement, with a few years of follow-up, I think you could make that argument both ways. But the point that you were both discussing about the impact of BRCA on CDK would also make me favor giving the PARP inhibitor first. We certainly would not give these together due to lack of safety data and risk of compound toxicity, particularly cytopenia. And Joyce, the point you were just bringing up about the RB mutations is also very interesting. We know that double hits in RB are relatively rare in the metastatic setting for resistance to CDK inhibitors. And often the second hit is difficult to detect on sequencing. It could be like a loss of heterozygosity. So you'll have one hit and then you'll lose the second copy, but it may not be from a point mutation. It may be just that you lose the copy and you don't pick it up as readily on circulating tumor DNA or even on solid biopsy because there's heterogeneity amongst the different sites. So when we have the BRCA mutation, we have this interesting biology in terms of RB. It may be difficult to detect, especially in the early stage setting, but we're learning a lot about this in the metastatic setting. We're also learning about non-genomic ways that RB can be disrupted. We're looking at epigenetic profiling and other things. So my opinion is that the concept of dual hits in RB for resistance to CDK being rare on the order of 5 to 10%, we may be missing a lot of this in ways that are not detectable from conventional circulating tumor DNA. And how that feeds into resistance to adjuvant CDK inhibitors and how that may inform our approach in the metastatic setting is a very interesting question, and I think will be a topic of a lot of interesting translational work in the next few years.
Thank you. Yeah, very, very, very interesting. It would be good to know, particularly in these BRCA two patients. We talked about the CDK4/6 inhibitor for this particular patient. I think we're all on the same page. She's so high risk, and in monarchE, patients have been off at least 4 years, and now we have a survival advantage. But where do you guys use adjuvant ribociclib? In your practices. How about you, Seth? What do you do there?
I think for a patient who meets the kind of lower end of the risk criteria for Natalie, who would not meet criteria for monarchE, it's a pretty straightforward calculation in my mind. So somebody, for example, who has N1 disease that wouldn't meet criteria for monarchE, or those high-risk N0 patients who would have qualified for Natalie, I would offer ribociclib across the board. I think for the patients who meet criteria for both, this is an area of active debate. I tend to take the same view that Virginia mentioned, which is we have not just a longer duration of follow-up, it's the total amount of follow-up. It's also the amount of follow-up off drug, because Natalie was a 3-year course and monarchE was a 2-year course. We really want to have confidence that when everybody on the trial is off drug, the curves are not kind of collapsing together like they did, for example, with Penelope B. And I think we're very confident now that that's the case for monarchE. The direction of the curves for Natalie looks similar, but I think we need even a little bit more follow-up. And obviously, we don't have mature overall survival yet for Natalie. So for the patients who meet both, I tend to err on the side of using abemaciclib unless they can't take it. For example, they have underlying GI issues or they're having really bad toxicity despite dose reduction with GI-related issues. Perhaps if they were had a history of thrombotic, complications and they weren't on anticoagulation, I would have a discussion with, hematology about it. So there may be rare exceptions to that, but I tend to draw a pretty clear line when the patient meets criteria for both.
Thank you. Thank you. Seth, how about you, Virginia? Where do you tend to use the ribociclib?
I agree with Seth. I use it in the patients that meet criteria for NATALEE, but not MONARCH E. Now, there's a small patient population that meets criteria for both that, as Seth mentioned, you get the feeling most of these patients have received chemotherapy. You get the feeling of how well their body can tolerate our treatments, or maybe they really has taken a toll. The chemotherapy has taken a toll on them, and I know that I have one chance. If I blow it with that one chance, they're going to say, I don't want anything. I'm not trying anything again. The 400 milligrams of ribociclib is really easier, even if we try to dose escalate the abemaciclib. So in that patient population where I know that I need to succeed with that one time, I might give ribociclib too. But that's a very small patient population.
I agree with you guys entirely. I do the same exact thing in terms of choosing, but I think it's so important that patients who are eligible for NATALEE really get offered ribociclib if they are eligible for both, that they get offered one or the other. It's just there is underutilization still going on around the country, so we definitely want to try to remember this for patients as much as we can. So a question about the use of PARP inhibitors in the curative setting. Have you ever had the chance to give off of a study a PARP inhibitor preoperatively? And what about using the PARP inhibitor for a germline PALB2 mutation, let's say? So Seth, how about you?
I actually am. I'm thinking. I don't think that I've deployed a PARP inhibitor in the neoadjuvant setting. I think there have been some smaller trials looking at this, like window of opportunity. I think it underscores the importance, especially in a patient like the one we were just discussing, where you're sort of torn. You know, the chemotherapy biologically maybe isn't going to have as much of an impact, but you feel compelled to give it pre or postoperatively. Developing better targeted strategies based upon genomic alterations in the tumor, whether they're germline or acquired, I think is a really important initiative for us. And that's true, I think, in the pre and postoperative setting. I wouldn't do this outside of a clinical trial. If we had a compelling clinical trial where it made sense to do this and we had flexibility, like many of these preoperative studies built in for us to make appropriate adjustments. We have studies like this, for example, with ADCs, where we get 4 cycles of an ADC preoperatively. You get to repeat imaging, and then the clinician can choose if the patient's having a great response to go to surgery, if the response looks suboptimal to give additional cytotoxic chemotherapy up front. I would be interested in something like that if there was an opportunity. The PALB2, I think, makes good sense. I have used PARP inhibitors for patients with PALB2 mutations, primarily in the metastatic setting, in my experience. And I've had, at least anecdotally, patients have good disease control and responses there. I've had some patients who really were not good candidates for cytotoxic treatment, had the PALB2. We had to sometimes jump through some hoops doing the ordering and the prior authorization, but I've gotten benefit from that, at least in the metastatic setting.
Thank you. If you had a high-risk germline PALB2 patient who was otherwise, would have been an Olympia trial, 4 more nodes or something, would you try to get her the a year of olaparib, for that PALB2?
I think it would be very compelling to consider that based on what we know about the biology of these pathways and the way that the PALB2 patients respond in the metastatic setting to these PARP inhibitors, particularly in a situation where the patient meets all of the highest risk criteria that we've been discussing, right? Multi-node positive disease, larger tumors, you're concerned about her ability to have optimal risk reductions with cytotoxic chemotherapy. So the biology here makes good sense to me. The drug is generally very well tolerated, with a few notable exceptions and some rare side effects that we can discuss. But I would consider it.
Thank you. Thank you. How about you, Virginia? Had a chance to either use a preoperative PARP inhibitor off study, and how about the adjuvant germline PALB2 patient?
So I've not used it preoperatively. There's some nice data generated, as Seth mentioned, from small trials. I would love to do this for GAIN-like approach. for all of these patients. So, giving them a couple of cycles of something, looking at the response, and then adjusting your treatment based on that. And I think this is really what we need to be working on more. This is how we will optimize our therapy and not give more treatment than we need to or less treatment than we need to. As far as the PALB2, I had one patient, she had a high-risk disease. She was PALB2 positive. The data on the metastatic setting, it looks pretty good. Interestingly, the response rates are not as high as what we see with the BRCA1 and 2, but they're higher than all of the other mutations that are in the pathway that we can use a PARP inhibitor for. So I personally would give it, but obviously would have to have a big discussion with the patient because this is not part of the guidelines.
Thank you. And I thought that there was a footnote in the NCCN around PALB2 as a potential option, but not on the actual guidelines itself. I could be wrong about that, but I thought that there was some support, for it, because, and that paper just came out in JCO from Joe Chen. No, sorry, Nadine Tung. Nadine Tung, I beg your pardon, showing about an 82% response rate with olaparib in the metastatic setting for the germline PALB2, and so and PALB2 and BRCA2 work so similarly in terms of DNA repair. They're so similar. So it's partner of BRCA2 is what PALB2 is, a partner. So they work really together. So I've had maybe two patients that met the Olympia criteria, but they were PALB2, and I was able to get one. I had to jump through the hoops pretty good on, but the other one I got it more easily for the patient. I had one young woman who had had an ACT like regimen for she's a germline BRCA2, and she had bilateral mastectomy, and then she came back on her chest wall a few years later with a small cancer, like 1.5 centimeter, very very high grade cancer, and hadn't been too long since she had had her ACT. So we gave her preoperative olaparib. And she had a really, it disappeared right away. She had a little bit of disease left, like a 1 or 2 millimeters she had l left, but she had, clear resection, radiation, and then it never came back again. So outside of a trial, I've done it maybe once for a patient. And let's finish up with this issue of HR positive, HER2 negative, grade 3 high risk breast cancer. Here we have a patient who's 57, T3N1, and it's grade 3. It's ductal, ER positive, HER2 negative, and she's going to get, a weekly paclitaxel followed by AC. Now, what about checkpoint inhibitor therapy for her? Do you ever think we could have a wolf in sheep's clothing here? Could this be like a basal? Do we need to know that? What kind of hints do we have here that we may say, wait a minute, rather than give her ACT or TAC, maybe we want to give her KEYNOTE-522. What do you guys do with that in practice? We don't have the data yet on the KEYNOTE-756, bringing in the preoperative pembrolizumab for the grade 3 ER positive, HER2 negative patient. We need the event-free survival data in KEYNOTE-756. We're not doing that across the board, right, for the grade 3 patients. But what about these sneaky ones that might actually be more basal-like in their biology? What do you do with that, Virginia?
So there's two trials. We mentioned the KEYNOTE-756, and then we have the CheckMate-7FL trial. Both of them looked at this high-risk HR-positive breast cancer patient population, giving chemotherapy plus minus IO. Both of them showing an improvement in pathologic complete response, but obviously we don't have any long-term outcomes. This is definitely not standard of care. These drugs are not approved in this setting. It might be a little hard to get them approved for the patients. But I think there are patients that would meet criteria for this. So on both trials, it looked like PD-L1 testing was an important predictor of who would get PCR and who wouldn't. And so that would be one thing that we did not see happening in the triple negative patient population, but in the ER positive, it did. And so before I gave these, I would definitely try to get a PD-L1 to see if this is positive or not. Now, there's a patient population, as you alluded to, Joyce, that are, the low ER, maybe 1 to 10%, maybe 15% or so, that also were shown on these trials to have the most benefit from immunotherapy. And those, I think I feel pretty comfortable giving IO to even without checking to see whether they're basal or not. The ones that I struggle with are the ones that maybe their ER is 40, 50%, but their PR is negative, and then they're grade three, and you could tell this is an aggressive tumor, and then what do? And maybe you get a 21 gene recurrence score, and that's extremely high. I think those would be where I would be very happy to get a PD-L1, and if it's positive, try to offer immunotherapy to these patients.
Thank you. Thank you, Virginia. How about you, Seth? What do you, because we got a spectrum of biology here. So how do you sort through maybe a few extra steps to see what the best treatment is?
Yeah, impossible for me to improve on Virginia's very comprehensive answer there. I completely agree. We have the, as you said, the 756 and the CheckMate data suggesting that there is activity here, but it's not yet standard. And we need, as you mentioned, Joyce, that event-free survival. And I completely agree. There's a difference between kind of a high-risk grade three strongly ER-positive tumor. We don't have the percentage here for this patient on the case versus the patient who really has ER borderline or low disease, that 1 to 10, even maybe up to 20% high-grade PR negative, HER2 negative. So I routinely, for the patient who's really on the borderline with the low ER, would sort of try to hedge a little bit and treat with KEYNOTE-522, understanding that the disease really looks triple negative biologically. I still may offer that patient adjuvant endocrine therapy, even if she has a path CR, because I know that there was some degree of ER positivity. Now, if she has residual disease that's strongly ER positive, okay, then the chemo and the IO has kind of eradicated the majority, the bulk of the tumor that was ER negative, and what's left behind is strongly ER positive. So I would optimize for that. If she has a path CR, I would still offer, but if she was having a lot of side effects and toxicity, I might have a lower threshold to discontinue. For the patient with a little bit higher ER, this is where it gets really tricky. The one that Virginia mentioned, like the 40%, maybe ER kind of moderate grade three, that's getting a little bit higher than I would traditionally give, like KEYNOTE-522 without any hesitation. So I think we need that data from KEYNOTE-756 to help us. To Virginia's point, I think we need to have a better understanding of the PD-L1 status of these tumors because that does play an important role here. I think in the future, this may be a way to personalize treatment for those patients who are in the middle, kind of on the gray zone. And there may be additional biomarkers or intrinsic subtypes that we can utilize to help us deploy that. But for right now, I think I'm completely in line. That's a long way of saying I agree with everything Virginia just said.
Right. And I think what you guys just said really is the standard of care. And I think that really nails it very importantly. And the only thing I'll add, which is not standard of care, this is not like a must-do situation, okay? But we do know now from a few studies that there's a subset of ER positive, HER2 negative breast cancers that are basal if we do intrinsic subtyping. And there was a study done called the PROMISE trial, preoperatively big registry study, looking at intrinsic subtyping, and the ER positive HER2 negatives that were basal was 13%. And when they got ACT, they had path CR rates that were, very, very good, like 40 plus percent. If they were luminal B, they had 6%. So like, wow, it really delineated the chemotherapy sensitivity. Then in the I-SPY trial, you have to have mammoprint print high to get on the I-SPY. So that's a subset. And of the mammoprint print high risk, ER positive, HER2 negative, it's 34% that are basal-like, okay? And again, they do very, very well with chemotherapy. So if I have someone who has a ER 40, 50% PR negative, but the Ki-67 is off the charts, you know what I mean? It's 80, 90, 100%, just like a triple negative breast cancer. We know these ER antibodies are pretty variable around the country, And I will send for a blueprint. I will send intrinsic subtyping. And if that patient comes back basal, I will treat the patient like a triple negative breast cancer. But that is not standard of care. It's not on the NCCN guidelines. But I think that the data are suggesting that there is a subset of these ER positives that have a biology more like triple negative breast cancer. So But let's hope the KEYNOTE-756 trial is positive. That would be awesome. We really, really need to make some additional progress for these grade three node positive, HR positive, HER2 negative cancers. They're pretty difficult cancers, and a lot of people die of that disease. So hopefully the KEYNOTE-756 will show EFS improvement. So Seth and Virginia, great pleasure as always talking about the cases with you, what we're doing in our practice. Thank you so much. And thanks everybody for listening.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.